The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Advertising Corporation and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found in this Washington Times Community column, Forbidden Siegel Talk.
It's time now for The Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you wonder how anybody could be so stupid as to believe a book of fairy tales like the Bible. Well, my friend, I give you a free pass for that comment because I used to say the same thing, and I do understand where you're coming from. I was an atheist for the first 18 years of my life, and then an agnostic for a little while. Even when I came to the conclusion that some kind of God existed, I certainly didn't think he was the God of the Bible. I mean, come on. Adam and Eve, Noah's Ark, give me a break. But as it happened, as is often the case in life, I formed my opinion without really having any data to back it up. Upon better investigation, or more correctly put, upon honest investigation for the first time in my life, I discovered that the Bible is exactly what it claims to be, the Word of God. And this very same Bible is corroborated by ancient history and archaeology. Now, speaking about the Bible, speaking of defending the Bible, you may recall that 2 weeks ago, I responded to some critical comments from a Muslim named Ahmad. I read his comments over the air. I invited him on the air to come on my radio show and debate me. Some of you are probably curious to know what kind of response we got from him, because today would have been the day. Well, here it is. Here is the response of Mr. Ahmad after he was challenged to come on my radio program. Now, it's possible the guy responded over the internet on some website, but he was specifically asked to email me if he wanted to be on the show, and I said we'd bring in a moderator and we'd set the whole thing up. I will not go searching on the internet for his comments. You have to develop a thick skin in this business, and part of that means not reading every piddly little thing that people write about you. Occasionally, yes, it's appropriate to pick just one sample piece and respond. I did that 2 weeks ago, and I did it with quite a bit of detail. Ahmad, the tough-talking blowhard, was challenged to contact me personally and come on the show for a debate. This he did not do, and I'm going to be honest with you, I never expected it for a second. However, my offer was sincere. Had he contacted us, I would have put him on. If instead of contacting us and coming on the air, he just went and wrote more drivel on websites, then the man is a coward. Now, next week, though, we're going to have a guy who's not a coward. He was on last week, Wesley, and we're working on the format. If we can agree to the format, it looks like Wesley will be on. But he already came on before, and I don't agree with Wesley either, but at least the guy's a stand-up guy, and he'll come on, and he'll defend himself, and that I admire. Anyway, I will talk more about the historicity and accuracy of the Bible later on in today's program. First, some news analysis. And boy, there's so much news. Where do you start? Are you getting depressed by the news in the country and the news around the world? You having trouble cutting to the bone and understanding the bare minimum of what's going on? Have no fear. Your old pal Bob is going to give you the Reader's Digest version. Media spin. Republicans passing the budget and approving the debt ceiling minus Obamacare is extreme. It's anarchist. It's what terrorists do. One of Obama's guys said they might as well strap a bomb to their chest. On the other hand, Obama saying he will shut the government down unless his Obamacare is funded. Oh, that's not extreme, is it? Obama refuses to discuss the debt with Republicans, but he expresses interest in opening up talks with Iran's Holocaust-denying administration. Gotta just love it. Amazing how the Ayatollah, who pulled the strings of President Ahmadinejad, now cooperates with a new peaceful Iranian president, and supposedly we're supposed to believe those strings are not being pulled anymore. Of course, this new peaceful, more diplomatic, kinder, gentler president of Iran in the past went on record to say that Israel needs to be removed from existence. Well, don't worry about it. I don't think there should be any concern. After all, Iran is a Muslim nation, and we know how peaceful of a religion Islam is. For that matter, Iraq is also a Muslim nation. It's always peaceful over there. And, well, Egypt is a Muslim nation, so is Syria, so is Libya. And then there's ethnic cleansing going on all over not only the Middle East, but Africa. Churches being burnt down, synagogues being burnt down, malls being shot up, Muslims against Christians every time, going into a room saying, if you're a Muslim, you can leave, everybody else stay so we can kill you. It's sure hard to be a Muslim apologist these days. If you boil it all down to brass tacks, the Muslim apologist's words could be summed up like so. Honestly, Islam is the religion of peace. We can see where it may not always look that way. Oh, speaking of which, have you heard the good news? Syria promises to turn their weapons over to the inspectors, their chemical weapons. Sleep well tonight, because their word is good as gold. Are you finally catching on? Are you finally getting it? President Obama is clueless with foreign policy. He simply does not know what he's doing. Unfortunately, he knows just exactly what he's doing with domestic policy. And that is a bigger problem. And then they say, Bob, at least you got to respect the office. He's your president. You got to show some respect. Oh, like the respect all of you showed George Bush. Look, let me be clear. I do respect the office of president too much to respect the man who is currently holding it. But which is worse, our president or our courts? It may be a photo finish. New Mexico may not yet be on the list of states which legally recognize gay marriage, but that didn't stop the state Supreme Court from ruling against a photographer who refused to take pictures of a same-sex wedding. The United States Constitution's First Amendment did not seem to stop them either. Now, some New Mexico counties hand out marriage certificates to same-sex couples. Some do not. The neutral nature of its statewide law is the source of conflicting opinion. New Mexico does not literally comment upon same-sex marriage one way or the other. That's the present state. In the meantime, as if playing a game of leapfrog, the New Mexico Supreme Court ignored New Mexico's current situation and skipped ahead to affirm a right that goes beyond a marriage license. They have essentially ruled that same-sex couples have a right to any wedding photographer they choose, even a photographer who objects for religious reasons. The business in question is Elaine Photography, a small home-based company run by Elaine... I don't know if I'm going to be pronouncing her name correctly. Elaine Huguenin, I believe, is the pronunciation. And if I'm pronouncing it incorrectly, Elaine, I am sorry, because I actually admire the stand you're taking. But Elaine Huguenin, I believe, is the pronunciation, with her husband and co-owner Jonathan. Yeah, I got that one. Jonathan. It's pronounced Jonathan. Got it. Elaine chose not to photograph a same-sex ceremony. She felt that doing so would run contrary to her religious beliefs, something she and Jonathan agreed that they would never allow, in as much as they view their business as an actual Christian ministry. I'm quoting Elaine. She said, "We wanted to make sure that everything we photographed, everything we used our artistic ability for, everything we told a story for or conveyed a message of would be in line with our religious views." Elaine's convictions were tested when an email from Vanessa Willock expressed interest in hiring Elaine Photography to do a photo shoot of a commitment ceremony between her and a girlfriend. Elaine answered her back. She said, "We do not photograph same-sex weddings. Again, thanks for checking out our site. Have a great day." Now, folks, her message said nothing demeaning. Certainly those words could never be confused for hate speech. Neither was the same-sex couple forbidden to have their ceremony photographed by a different company. There are all kinds of photographers out there to choose from. Elaine had reason to believe the matter was settled. She was wrong. Woo! Boy, was she wrong. 3 months later, Vanessa Willick filed a complaint with the New Mexico Human Rights Commission. They found Elaine guilty of discrimination and ordered her to pay Willick over $6,000. The case eventually went to New Mexico's Supreme Court, which ruled last month on behalf of the lesbian couple, stating that Elaine's refusal, and I quote them, violated the New Mexico Human Rights Act in the same way as if it had refused to photograph a wedding between people of different races. And they added, this was the price of citizenship. Even when religious convictions are involved. Let me repeat that because I would hope you would find that chilling. This is the price of citizenship, even when religious convictions are involved. Well, what about Elaine's rights of speech, rights of freedom of religion? These concerns were raised by the Alliance Defense Fund. That's a nonprofit organization that specializes in defending religious liberty and is currently representing Elaine Photography. ADF Senior Counsel Jordan Lawrence said, and I'm quoting him, government-coerced expression is a feature of dictatorships that has no place in a free country. The idea that free people can be compelled by law to compromise the very religious beliefs that inspire their lives as the price of citizenship is a chilling and unprecedented attack on freedom. Americans are now on notice that the price of doing business is their freedom. We are considering our next steps, including asking the United States Supreme Court to right this wrong. Unfortunately, the United States Supreme Court hasn't shown a lot of sympathy itself lately to those who espouse traditional marriage. It might be fair to ask if their recent decision striking down part of DOMA and refusing to hear an appeal for Prop 8 emboldened New Mexico's Supreme Court. Whatever their inspiration, the New Mexico Supreme Court does not view its late August ruling as a violation of the First Amendment. Now, I find that extraordinary. But they insisted that New Mexico's anti-discrimination laws do not contradict free speech because no law, in their words, no law forces Elaine Photography to either speak a government-mandated message or to publish the speech of another. The court also pointed out that Elaine Photography could advertise that they were personally opposed to same-sex marriage, should they so desire, hence no violation of the First Amendment. Ironically, the court is merely expressing its own opinion about the rapport between religious freedom and society at large. That opinion, like all opinions, is protected under the very amendment in discussion. But when a judge turns an opinion into a decision based upon an interpretation of the law, it may be appropriate for Americans everywhere to reread the First Amendment's religion statement and see if it really needs any special interpretation. These are the words. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Now, do you really need some judge to tell you what that means? You're not capable of reading that for yourself? When a businesswoman believes that by photographing a gay wedding, she is disobeying God. When this same woman is ordered by judges to violate her convictions or face a penalty, isn't the free expression of her religion being prohibited? Can a judge demand something that Congress itself cannot demand according to the Constitution? In any event, Elaine's remaining court-affirmed free speech may not be around much longer for her or anybody else. That, too, is on the radar of militant gay activists. They have not been shy about stating their ultimate agenda. It's just that most people in the country haven't been listening, haven't been paying attention. As far back as 1987, we've been told exactly what they plan to do. At that time, gay rights spokesman Jeff Levy talked with sobering honesty to the National Press Club in Washington. I'm quoting him. We are no longer seeking just a right to privacy and a protection from wrong. We also have a right, as heterosexual Americans already have, to see government and society affirm our lives. Ladies and gentlemen, how do you insist that an entire society affirm something without challenging freedom of speech? What about those who cannot, in good conscience, affirm a homosexual lifestyle for religious reasons or maybe some other reason? When one group of people demands affirmation, how does the First Amendment apply to everybody? Unless Americans figure out the answer to this question soon, we may find ourselves drifting with the same tide that pulled away Ireland, England, Norway, Canada, Sweden. Those countries already restrict verbal criticism of homosexuality. Will this happen in America too? Yeah, probably. Where there's smoke, there's fire. When government feels free to interfere with religious actions, what will stop it from regulating religious speech? What will stop it from regulating any kind of speech? Under fair conditions, a majority of American citizens could speak loudly until the government starts paying better attention to the Constitution. Unfortunately, fair conditions are waning. Matters of religious freedom are less likely to be determined by the majority and more likely to end up as court rulings in the fine tradition of New Mexico. Did you know a recent Rasmussen poll indicates that the public would probably have vindicated Elaine Photography? Rasmussen specifically asked, suppose a Christian wedding photographer has deeply held religious beliefs opposing same-sex marriage. If asked to work a same-sex wedding ceremony, should that wedding photographer have the right to say no? 85% said the photographer should have the freedom to say no, but public opinion is fast giving way to judicial activism. The tail is wagging the dog. Americans need to wake up. Look, this is for any citizen. I don't care if you're gay or straight. I don't care if you're liberal or conservative. I don't care if you're Republican or Democrat. You should take heed and realize that New Mexico's decision is a poisonous assault upon our First Amendment freedom. Liberals may find the ruling convenient at this particular moment, but what happens next time? What happens when a future court decision removes some other freedom, maybe a freedom you care about? Our country needs to have a serious dialogue which revisits the checks and balances between our judiciary and the other two branches of government. Maybe we can begin by asking Rasmussen and similar pollsters to pose a new question. Ask our men and women in uniform if they are sacrificing their lives and spilling blood to fight for an oligarchy or a free society governed by a constitution and republic. Actually, we already know the answer. But knowledge means nothing without courage. Our country needs a few people who are willing to march to the beat of a different drum. People who are willing to make their own kind of music. That was the title of a hit song back in the year 1969 by Cass Elliot of Mamas and Papas fame. This was a solo song she did. The song received a second life just a few years ago by some of you fans that follow Lost. You might recall this song opened up season 2 of that hit series, Lost. But the words are for all ages. If our society is going to survive, we need a few brave people who will make their own kind of music.
Nobody can tell you there's only one song worth singing. They may try and sell you. To do your thing, the hardest thing to do. But you gotta make your own kind of music. Sing your own special song. Make your own kind of music, even if nobody else sings along. So if you take my hand,
Bob now at 888-344-1170. That's toll free, 888-344-1170. Bob may have strong opinions, but he also likes to hear what you have to say.
This is Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated, license number 480539, W&S Electric. Welcome back to KCBQ 1170. I'm your host, Bob Siegel. If you'd like to weigh in on any of this, of course, you can reach me on Facebook, Twitter, or directly over the internet. Questions at BobSiegel.net. That's questions at BobSiegel, SIEGEL.net. And I have some comments here, some responding to my radio monologues and some responding to, I guess you could say, literary versions of them in my online column, Forbidden Table Talk. Such a column corresponded with today's monologue, and I have this letter from Charles. Hey, Bob, just read your post about how religious freedom, quote unquote, was denied by the New Mexico Supreme Court in reference to the photographer who thought it was acceptable to discriminate against the gay couple in the name of their religion. You are so confused. So if you go to Walmart and you check out with beer, among other things, imagine if the cashier who was checking you out announced that you had to go to someone else's lane because you're violating her religious convictions. This actually happened in Minnesota in the 90s when Muslim taxi drivers stopped providing transportation to anyone who was carrying alcohol with them. You're entitled to your religious beliefs and rituals. You can practice them all you want, but you can practice them all you want, but if you own a business, no, Bob, and he puts no and Bob in capital letters. So I guess the way that's supposed to sound is no, Bob, you cannot deny services to people because you deem them bad or in violation of your convictions. Society would be so chaotic if we allowed business owners to pick and choose who they served and who they denied services to. Imagine all the rednecks in southern states who would deny services to blacks, Muslims, interracial couples. Oh, boy, see, now in the name of racism, he's making quite a sweeping generalization about rednecks, isn't he? Boy, if I were a redneck, I'd really like that comment. Supposedly, rednecks would be racist if they were given an opportunity to. Imagine all the rednecks in southern states, not just rednecks in the north, rednecks in you southern states, mind you, who would deny services to blacks, Muslims, interracial couples, individuals they speculated to be undocumented, quote unquote. Wow, there's a lot loaded there, Charles, my friend. Anyway, Charles continues, stop perverting the meaning of religious freedom. Our Constitution allows you to believe as you wish. It does not grant you permission to discriminate in the workforce or in public based on who conforms to your dogma versus who does not. Well, first of all, Charles, thank you for that kind, friendly response. Your words certainly demonstrate the kind of tolerance and compassion that people always accuse Christians of not having. As for the points you made, Charles, African Americans were treated abominably during those Jim Crow laws. But how sad that today we live in a time when refusing to serve food or refusing a hotel room or refusing to give a cab ride has to be confused with refusing to physically participate in an action that somebody might consider sinful based upon a religious freedom granted in our Constitution. Now, I believe you're a bright enough person to process things for yourself. Instead of marching to the beat of the PC drum, surely you can see that we are comparing apples with oranges. There's also the related issue to our threatened freedom of speech down the road. Part of the militant gay agenda, the primary concern of my monologue and article, this, my friend, you failed to respond to at all. This next one is from Fabian, not the singer, just somebody on the internet that calls himself Fabian. Fabian says, if you were a photographer and an interracial couple asked you to photograph their wedding, could you refuse because your religion disagrees with it? No. Sit down. Fabian, before you go around ordering people to sit down, are you aware that many African-American civil rights leaders find that comparison offensive? They see a difference between skin color and a chosen lifestyle. Even if you wanted to claim that homosexuals are born that way, which has never been proven, it is believed by some that people are born with a propensity toward alcoholism, too. Would a photographer be allowed to decline a wedding where people were getting drunk? Could they decline based upon their religious reasons? Of course they could. Why? Because defending an alcoholic hasn't become politically correct yet. Oh, and since you're so free with your advice to me, I will respond in kind with some advice of my own. Stop repeating talking points and learn to navigate through these issues yourself. In any event, Anne on Facebook agreed with what I said. Here's Anne's comment. It is ludicrous that the state is punishing a photographer for moral views in not photographing a same-sex marriage that is not even legal in the state. They have made the assumptive and wrong jump from sexual preference being a quality to being a civil rights group and now punishing people as if they were being racist. It is an error in reasoning, though that is getting legitimized by the state of New Mexico. United States civil rights laws protect certain protected classes of citizens, race, age, disability, sex, meaning male and female. But even though sexual preference has not been added to the civil rights law, it is being treated as such by some courts, and new rights, quote unquote, are being found, quote unquote, that directly impact anyone who objects. This is clearly wrong and progressive misinterpretation of law in the United States. It has never been proven that someone cannot change their orientation, and the gay community knows the fear of losing a boyfriend or a girlfriend to an opposite sex relationship, which of course points to the fact that they know that sexual preference is not immutable or unchangeable, but are carrying on as if it is for political purposes. That was very well said, Anne. Regarding Obama having talks with Iran but not Republicans, Renee on Facebook says, sounds like Barack Hussein Obama has his priorities straight if his ultimate objective is to destroy America. Renee? Of course that's his objective. And then he will remake America in his own image. You could hold a copy of Saul Alinsky's book, Rules for Radicals, in one hand, read the daily news on the other hand, and predict Obama's next move every step along the way. His spokespeople refer to the Republicans as terrorists because they don't like his health care law. Meanwhile, who are the people that Obama won't call terrorists? Terrorists. This is from Al, responding to a radio show I did, oh boy, it was about a month ago, at least a few weeks ago, where I shared over the air a very special, very specific answer to prayer. And I, in that prayer, you'll recall, I had asked God to give me exactly $100. This was back in the 70s when $100 was a lot more money. 2 days later, a friend who knew nothing about my prayer sent me a letter. Inside was a note, and the note said that God had laid it on his heart to write me a check. Inside was exactly $100. Al was kind of intrigued by this. He says, hey, Bob, you'd better be telling the truth with your pact with God and the two-day expiration. It's a toughie. 2 days after your powwow, the $100 arrived. Now tell me how you hook up that closely with God. Well, Al, the good news is I am telling you the truth. That really happened. Bad news, Al, I wish I could say I'm always that close to God. I'm not. But I do believe he reaches out and wants to be that close to all of us. Al also says, love to know how he's so selective. He isn't selective, Al. He accepts any who come to him through the forgiveness of Jesus. There's nothing special or unique about me. He's reaching out to you as well. You have but to reach back and respond to his love. Al, God loves you so much. If you were the only person in this world, he would have become a man, Jesus, and he would have died on the cross just for you. While he was on the cross, he was thinking about you. He was thinking about your sins and me and my sins, but he was thinking about you, Al. Now, this is from Diana. This is another Bible-related question. Diana's one of our regular listeners. She says, "Hi, Bob. I was reading the book The Shack. It is a Christian fiction book. In the book, it answers basic Christian questions in a story form. After I read the book, a question came to mind. I was always taught that a sin was a sin in God's eyes. No matter what the sin was, God saw them all the same. I have always struggled with that. Didn't Jesus say that a sin committed to a child was the worst? How could all sins be the same? For example, a married man sees an attractive woman on the street or store, which he may never see again, and his wife isn't with him, and certain thoughts go on in his head. Then another married man cheats on his wife. Isn't the latter the worst sin? Or like stealing and murder, isn't murder worse? So many examples I could give. Does God really count all sins the same, and why? Some might be so innocent, like a neighbor being envious over a new car the other neighbor just got, and worshiping a false god. How could they be the same? Some sins might last a second and not be repeated, and some sins might last a lifetime. If this is true and all sins are the same, I don't think I could ever get my head to understand it." You're asking an excellent question, Diana. Let me see if I can clarify this. Some sins are worse than others, but any sin, small or large, keeps us from God and heaven. So as far as penalty goes, they are all the same because God is so holy that we are evil by comparison. But of course, sins like murder or abusing children are worse than sins like arrogance or gossip. Imagine if they were holding a swim marathon and we were supposed to swim from the shores of California to the shores of Hawaii. Let's say I entered the race. Now, I used to body surf quite a bit. I still do occasionally. But if you had an Olympic swimmer like the famous Mark Spitz, he's going to get a lot farther than I am. In fact, it'll be no contest. But you know what? Mark Spitz wouldn't make it to Hawaii either. And it's like that with God and our sin. There are some people that live better lives than others, but the smallest sin disqualifies us from being in God's presence. Now, the good news is God loves us so much that he still sent his son Jesus to die for our sins. So the good news, the reverse of this, is although any sin would disqualify us from heaven on our own merits, at the same time, no sin, including the large ones like murder and adultery, no sin keeps us from God if we accept his forgiveness in Jesus Christ. Isn't that good news? That's exactly what the word gospel means. Good news.
Kids ask you questions about God and the Bible that you can't answer? Sign yourself or your child up for a class with lots of solid answers at educateforlife.org before someone else gives them the wrong answers. Are you tired of not knowing what to say when your friends and family ask you questions about God and the Bible? Get equipped by signing up for a class at educateforlife.org. When someone asks you, "How do you know the Bible's true?" do you say something like, "I just know it is"? If you're tired of giving lame answers, sign up for a class at educateforlife.org. When someone says that God isn't real, wouldn't it be fun to prove that he is? Quickly, like a verbal ninja? By using science and logic. Sign up for a class at educateforlife.org with Christian apologetics teacher Kevin Conover, and you'll learn how to do that. Educateforlife.org.
You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show. I've been reading some questions and comments coming through Facebook, questions at bobsiegel.net. Olivia, regular listener to our show, comments on Facebook that she likes the show a couple of weeks ago where I challenged Mr. Ahmad. So does Linda on Facebook. Linda writes, Bob, you are, as always, spot on. Keep it up. The Lord is using you as a mouthpiece to wake up the people of this country. That's very kind of you to say that, Linda. Look, he uses you too. I'm not unaware that you risk losing Facebook friends just to write a comment like that publicly. So thank you very much. That was very encouraging. This is from Dave. He writes regarding that same show, Bob Siegel's on-air rebuttal of Ahmad's was quite effective, calling him out on his misinformation as well as lack of understanding of key issues. Shadid and Ahmad, it is clear to me that neither of you understand what textual criticism is and its purpose as a discipline. If you did, then you would have immediately understood Bob's comment about scribal errors. You lost credibility with me here. You two need to study more carefully the salient issues concerning historiography, I should say. And Will, talking about the debate itself, that was a show commenting on the debate. Will listened to the show and then watched the debate online. He says, Bob did a great job of showing why the New Testament is trustworthy by addressing many of Shadid's great questions, including the question about consistencies between the Gospels. However, in my opinion, the most important points Bob made during the debate were at the beginning and the end of the debate. Bob started out by saying how the trail of breadcrumbs, including the truth in the New Testament, has led him and many millions worldwide into a relationship with Jesus Christ. Well, thank you for the encouraging words, Will. By the way, that debate about the accuracy of the New Testament is still linked to the very front page of my website, bobsiegel.net. And so, as you're hearing us talk about this debate about the Bible, and somebody who might have debated me about the Bible, it seemed like a good day for me to actually talk to you about the Bible. And let me start by saying that the key, most pivotal event in the Bible is the resurrection of Jesus Christ. If Jesus rose from the dead, and he did, it is an historical fact. If he rose from the dead, then everything he taught is true. And everything he believed was true. Because only God has the power to raise somebody from the dead. And if God is raising Jesus from the dead, he's putting his stamp of approval on Jesus being an actual prophet. And of course, as a prophet, he taught that he was actually an incarnation of God, God himself in the form of a man. But Jesus believed in the entire Old Testament. We talked earlier about the Genesis stories, Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel, Noah and the Ark. Jesus believed in that. Jesus referred to Genesis right from the beginning. He referred to Noah. He referred to Cain and Abel, or at least talked about Abel, the brother of Cain. He referred to Jonah and the fish. And so, you know, I know that Bill O'Reilly has a book out, and I'm a big fan of Bill O'Reilly, but Bill O'Reilly seems to believe in Jesus, but he doesn't think Jesus took the Old Testament seriously. Jesus did take the Old Testament seriously. He also commissioned his disciples and gave them special authority, and they later on wrote the book that we call the New Testament. Now, some of you were listening a moment ago when I said Jesus Christ's resurrection was an event of history, and I know a lot of you just about dropped your jaw and started clutching your chest. I know some of you who heard that on the freeway, maybe you're having accidents out there. I shouldn't say that. Somebody will go sue me for having an accident. All right, you're not having accidents. There, boom, I took care of that one. Look, the bias here is miracles. If the same amount of people who witnessed the resurrection of Jesus and the teachings of Jesus and the miracles of Jesus, if those same people merely claimed that a man named Jesus gave a speech or a man named Jesus started a revolution, who would doubt it? We immediately have this bias when we're talking about miracles. But a bias about miracles does not belong in a discussion about history. The only question a historian is allowed to ask is how many eyewitnesses were there? How credible were the eyewitnesses? Do the eyewitnesses come from different sources? The question of miracles, that's a question for philosophers. It's a question in metaphysics. It's a question in science. I don't mind taking a quick little detour. When the Bible talks about miracles, they're not claiming God waved a magic wand and threw science out the window. Human beings probably know less than 1% of all the obtainable knowledge in the universe. So how does God do his miracles? With the 99.9% of the knowledge that we don't have yet. Imagine somebody in 70 AD, looking into the future, 2,000 years into the future, and seeing you with your iPad with those little dancing images, or watching an airplane, or a television set, or an automobile, wouldn't those things look like a miracle to him? Well, we know that we just harness scientific data that they didn't have yet. Now, with the change in technology, and did you know that since from the 1980s to the present, there's been more change in technology than from the time of Abraham to the present? Can you just imagine what human beings will do even 50 years from now? How about 100 years from now? How about what human beings will do 1,000 years from now? Don't we just figure they're going to do things that would absolutely baffle our minds? And if we could peer into the future, it would look like magic to us. But we know it's not magic. We know they'll be harnessing some scientific laws that we haven't yet discovered or haven't yet harnessed. Well, if human beings could do that someday, why can't God do that right now? Science, if it's shown us one thing, and if it's shown us this thing over and over again, it's that what people frequently thought was impossible becomes very possible. Now, let's get back to the resurrection of Jesus Christ. First of all, there is history outside of the New Testament that corroborates the resurrection. But before I even go there, I don't want you to so quickly throw the Bible out. We do the Bible sometimes a disservice. For one thing, we call it one book. The New Testament alone is a collection of 27 different ancient manuscripts. Combined with the Old Testament, it's 66 different manuscripts. It's a library, and it's different kinds of literature. Some is history, some is prophecy, some is poetry. But the New Testament alone, you know, I have one of these too. My Bible, it's leather bound. It's got gold-plated pages. My name's engraved on the front. Some even have that nice deluxe red letter edition. That's great. But unfortunately, we make it look like such a quasi-mystical book that we don't look at it for what it actually is and what it claims to be, a collection of historical, ancient manuscripts. And one of the writers of two of the books, the book of Luke and the book of Acts, both written by a man named Luke. Luke was an historian in his day who was sponsored by a Roman dignitary named Theophilus to go to Judea, travel there, because there was such a hubbub going around about Christianity, and to interview the different eyewitnesses. We'll see about Luke and see how credible of a historian Luke was when we return to the Bob Siegel Show.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out Bob's weekly column for Washington Times Communities. Bob is also a regular contributor for San Diego Rostra and San Diego Newsroom. And don't forget his website, www.bobsiegel.net, S-I-E-G-E-L, bobsiegel.net. Here, you can download past radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and get information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net.
Talking about the historicity of the Bible, I mentioned before the break that Luke was an historian. Now, let me read to you from Luke and see if this sounds like somebody asking you to believe something by blind faith, or if he's talking about facts. "Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. Therefore, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, it seemed good also to me to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught. Now, there was a noted archaeologist, very big around the turn of the 20th century. His name was Sir William Ramsay. Sir William Ramsay went to some liberal German schools and was taught there that the Bible was a bunch of nonsense. And he set out to say that more acutely, to prove that Luke was a very inaccurate historian. He went off and did all kinds of archaeological digs in the Grecian-Roman world, and he came to the conclusion that Luke was not only an accurate historian, but he was more accurate than the other classical historians that we accept all the time. Now, I talked to an archaeology student one time. They said, "You can't count William Ramsay." I said, "Why not?" They said, "He's a Christian apologist." As if that meant he had some kind of disease. Of course, I'm a Christian apologist too. But I said, "Well, look, he became a Christian apologist, but he started out as an archaeologist trying to disprove Christianity. You're leaving out why he became a Christian apologist." By the way, there's been a lot of people like that. The famous Josh McDowell, who wrote Evidence That Demands a Verdict, set out to disprove the resurrection of Christ. Henry Morris, who wrote the bestseller Who Moved the Stone, set out to disprove the resurrection of Jesus Christ. You know, the guy that wrote the book Ben-Hur back in the 1800s in the Civil War days, General Lew Wallace, set out to disprove the resurrection of Jesus Christ. You know what he wrote instead? Ben-Hur. It goes on and on and on. Okay, so Luke was an historian. Now, John was not an historian, but John was an eyewitness. He was one of Jesus' disciples. He writes, and I'm reading from 1 John chapter 1, "That which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked at and our hands have touched, this we proclaim concerning the word of life. The life appeared, and we have seen it and testified to it, and we proclaim to you the eternal life which was with the Father and has appeared to us. We proclaim to you what we have seen and heard, so that you also may have fellowship with us, and our fellowship is with the Father and His Son, Jesus Christ. We write this to make our joy complete." Now, some of you are thinking, Bob, a disciple of Jesus doesn't count. That's not accurate history. I said, really? Why not? Because they were his friends. They knew him. They liked him. They had a bias. Look, welcome to the human race. We all have biases. All historians have biases. Winston Churchill was the Prime Minister of England. I have a multi-volume set in my office from Winston Churchill. It's called The Second World War. Who was right during World War II? England or Germany? You think the Prime Minister of England during that time had an opinion about that? Of course he did. Of course he had a bias. But let me ask the question another way, because sometimes it depends on how the question is asked. What historian, what World War II buff in his right mind would be uninterested in a book about World War II written by Winston Churchill? Say, if we apply the same rules of literary criticism, the same rules of valid history to the Bible that we apply to anything else, not only does it come out as accurate, it comes out embarrassingly so more accurate than any other history we accept from the ancient world and a good deal of history we accept since that time. Oh, Bob, if Jesus really existed, really did miracles, really resurrected, then somebody other than his disciples should have written about it. I want accurate history. I want accurate testimony. But the men that knew him the most, followed him around for 3 years, ate with him, slept next to him, they don't count. That's ridiculous. You would never put another historical figure up to that kind of scrutiny. And you know what? Having said that, there are people who didn't like Jesus, whose bias was predisposed against him. One would be the Jewish leaders. Now, before you call the show and say we're guilty of anti-Semitism, I am Jewish. A Jewish Christian, to be sure, but Jewish nevertheless. Both my parents are Jewish. I was born a Jew. I am not anti-Semitic. And the Bible doesn't teach in the New Testament that the Jews didn't like Jesus. It teaches there was a big split in Israel. The main population loved him, followed him, called him the Messiah, or the Greek word Christos, Christ. It was the Jewish religious leaders that didn't like him. And that's because Jesus called them whitewashed tombs with dead bones inside. It would be like marching into a church today and accusing the pastor and priests of being hypocrites. But in the Talmud, And I'll tell you exactly where you can find this. This a section called Sanhedrin in the Babylonian Talmud. There is a passage where the Jewish court, which was kind of a puppet court under the Romans, takes responsibility for executing Jesus. Technically, they had to turn him over to the Romans. But religiously, they pronounced the charge before they went to Pontius Pilate. And they say they executed Jesus on the charge of sorcery and apostasy. Now, an apostate, that was a heretic. Now, why did they call him an apostate? Because he claimed to be God. For an ancient Jew to claim to be the God of Israel, which is the same as the God of the universe, that was as heretical as you could possibly get. Under the law of Moses, such a heretic would be stoned. He deserved to die unless, by chance, he really was the God of Israel. He was telling the truth. But they didn't believe he was, so of course they thought he was a heretic. We can understand why the Talmud would call Jesus an apostate. But I'm intrigued that they also called him a sorcerer. Why did they call him a sorcerer? Because in those days, if you didn't like somebody, and you didn't want to follow him, and you didn't want anybody else to follow him either, but you could not deny the fact that he did miracles, you said, oh, well, he didn't do those by the power of God. He did them by the power of Satan. Now, a lot of Jews today don't believe in Satan, but an Orthodox Jew will admit that there is a Satan. And in Jesus' day, they talked about Satan a lot. And what they were saying was he did his miracles by the power of Satan. Now, I know, Christians, you're hearing what's a very derogatory statement about Jesus, but from the pure point of view of the historian, this is good news because we have now a testimony, not just his disciples, which we collected in the New Testament that obviously were his friends and liked him, but now we have a testimony with a bias predisposed against Jesus. Nevertheless, it says that he lived, he existed, he was executed, and he did miracles. This is fantastic, corroborating history from people that didn't like Jesus, but it gets even better. Josephus was a Jewish historian who lived in Rome, wrote a history of Israel from the point of view of the Romans, took only a casual interest in Jesus, only mentioned him twice, spent much more time giving a comprehensive report on the reign of Governor Pontius Pilate. But at that time, here's what he said about Jesus. These are not the words of a Christian. This is not found in the New Testament. The words of Josephus. And I'm reading from Antiquities, Book 18, Chapter 3. Now there was about this time Jesus, a wise man, if it be lawful to call him a man, for he was a doer of wonderful works, a teacher of such men as received the truth with pleasure. He drove to him both many of the Jews and many of the Gentiles. He was the Christ. And when Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men amongst us, had condemned him to the cross, those that loved him at the first did not forsake him, for he appeared to them alive again at the third day, as the divine prophets had foretold these and 10,000 other wonderful things concerning him, and the tribe of Christians so named from him are not extinct to this day. Now, you might be wondering, if we have clear historical evidence like that, why don't more skeptics accept the resurrection of Jesus? Because what my atheist friends and skeptics are trying to do is to claim that Josephus never really wrote that. They're saying some Christian went and interpolated that. And listen, scholars, ancient historians, and archaeologists use Josephus all the time. It's true that what we have from Josephus today are copies and not the originals, but we don't have the originals of anything from the ancient world. We don't have the original writings of Sophocles. We don't have the original writings of Aristotle. We don't have the original writings of Plato, the annals of Julius Caesar, the Roman historian Tacitus, the Roman historian Suetonius. Everything comes through copies because in those days you couldn't save it on your hard drive. What can I say? These words from Josephus, they're there. They're in the same manuscript. It's there like everything else. I know there are certain reasons why people, that they have certain internal reasons to say Josephus cannot possibly have written this. On my website, you can order my book. And in my book, I do a whole chapter about Josephus's passage. It's called The Testimonium Flavianum. Look, if you don't want to buy the book, send me an email and I'll send you a free article that I've written that you won't have to pay for. And I'll explain this to you. In any event, I will see you next week. You are always welcome. Your questions are welcome too.
The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.